Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does Barack Obama's past influence what he believes and how he leads in the present? 2 years after the president's groundbreaking election, the country that put him in the White House is still struggling with depressing numbers of unemployed workers and foreclosed home mortgages, fierce conflicts overseas, and a debate over the new health care law no less strident now than in the months leading up to its passage. So are there clues in the president's personal history as to how he will respond to the ongoing challenges? David Remnick is editor of The New Yorker magazine and author of the biography The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. The book has just been updated with a new epilogue and re-released in trade paperback. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with your title, which I really like, but I have to ask whether you think that halfway into this term, Barack Obama is somewhat less of a bridge between different segments of the American population.
No, I don't think so at all. I think that the most radical aspect of Barack Obama, and I mean radical and without a value attached to it, is the fact that he's the first African-American president, and that's something that doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be something that we don't think about all that much as we're completely immersed in subjects that range from unemployment to what's going on in Egypt. But if you're a 10-year-old black kid or Hispanic or any other group that may feel disenfranchised or apart from the mainstream political process, if you're a 10-year-old black kid, your sense of horizon changed radically. 2 years ago when Obama was made president, your sense of possibility changed radically. I think that is an incredibly important thing. It's not everything. It doesn't solve the problems of the urban poor. It doesn't do a lot of things, but it changes things markedly.
You portray Obama here, and I should say not unflatteringly, as a sort of shapeshifter who communicates the same messages very differently according to his audience. Do you think his ability to do that so well is a factor of having spent most of his life as a person who had to always expend at least some extra effort in order to fit in?
Well, I think to some degree all great political communicators are shapeshifters. I think you can probably hear, by the way, the sirens of Times Square through the phone. I'm sorry about that, but such is life in New York. I think that all great communicators, political communicators, have the capacity to shift their tone, shift their sense of reference just enough to meet with their audience, as it were, to kind of bridge the gap between them. I mean, whether you're Martin Luther King or John Kennedy or Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama, you make adjustments, whether you're in a black church or in a white Methodist church or speaking to a foreign crowd, you make adjustments in that rhetoric. Obama, the reason it's important for him is that he had to learn how to do this. Barack Obama's not somebody who grew up in a black church on the south side of Chicago or in Harlem or in Dallas. He grew up in Hawaii, where there was no such thing. And the few blacks that are in Hawaii are on military bases. He really had to come to his racial identity, his ethnic identity, in a way that most of us don't. Most of us get it at the kitchen table and in our communities as children. He had to reach farther for it.
Yeah, you give us this amazing portrait of a young man who is sort of educating himself with books as to what it means to be an African-American in this country.
Well, not just books. I think that he did it by reading, certainly, by watching television, by meeting people, by getting off the rock, as they say in Hawaii, in other words, leaving Hawaii mm-hmm. and coming to Los Angeles and then at Occidental College and then Columbia University and then finally the south side of Chicago. And I think part of those moves were in pursuit of who he was, who he could be for a community and an identity. There's no doubt about that.
As you point out in the book, the title of his memoir, Dreams from My Father, belies the fact that, in fact, his mother had a huge influence on his life and his values. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't know how you feel about it, but I thought during the campaign that the image of Barack Obama's mother was like of a kind of aging hippie type in peasant skirt and, you know, idealistic cliches about the 60s. In fact, she's a much more interesting, more intelligent, idealistic, and independent person than all that, more complex. I guess all of us are more complex the more we know about each other. And in her case, you know, she was somebody who took these great risks in her marital and love life. She married a an African when she was a teenager, got pregnant, in fact, not in that order, divorced him pretty quickly. He kind of left her for the East Coast and then finally for Africa. And then she married an Indonesian, and she made a life partly in Indonesia. And the way she would come in and out of her children's lives was something very much before its time.
Did her work, she was an anthropologist, right?
That's right.
Did that have any influence
at all? She died when she was in her early 50s.
Yeah, yeah. Did that influence the way Obama understood his role within particular cultures, having lived in Indonesia and then in Hawaii? And then
I think almost certainly. I think that you've got to have a different view of the world, at least for a while, if one person is just stuck in one neighborhood and some corner of somewhere, and another person has a more worldly upbringing. Obama goes from this very distant outpost of the United States, meaning Hawaii, and moves around the states a lot. He spends a fair amount of time in Indonesia, both as a child, where he was for a few years, and then later on lots of visits. He traveled around South Asia with friends from college. It's a much more worldly beginning than somebody like his predecessor, who was a kind of combination of Connecticut and Texas, but whose foreign travels, even before becoming president, were next to none.
Hmm. Talk about this. You know, as you mentioned, she was sort of portrayed, his mother was portrayed as this sort of aging hippie. Mm-hmm. She, you know, had plenty of education, and she fought from the beginning for him to be in the very best schools.
Yeah, I can't tell you how unbelievably fancy Obama's high school was. This place called the Punahou School, not just high school, but grammar school. It's all one. I mean, it's a little bit like Eton or Phillips Exeter, or I don't know what the equivalent would be in Texas or California, but a really, really posh place combined with the atmosphere of Hawaii, where the weather is so good that the lockers are outdoors. It's very multi-ethnic because of that's the way Hawaii is. It's like no high school I'd ever seen in my life.
Why did Obama choose to become a lawyer? He had interest in a literary career.
Well, I hate to say it, but being a writer is hard and very unsure. And Obama knew that he could write and still be a lawyer. It's mm-hmm. hard to do the reverse.
Yeah.
And I think there was a two-stage thing, Chris. I think that he found, when he went to Chicago to be a community organizer, he found a sense of community, a sense of belonging, a sense of place, a sense of mission. But he knew that in order to fulfill that sense of ambition or sense of mission, he needed skills. That being a community organizer doesn't get you very far. You can't accomplish very much. It's that discovery that somebody might make as a young person in the Peace Corps or in Teach for America, and you realize, my God, I can barely help these 25 kids at all. Hmm. And if I'm going to try to change the world, I need skills. And so he went to Harvard Law School, and he got the skills that lawyers get. And as you know, a lot of lawyers, for better or for worse, enter political life. And I think that was his plan all along.
I thought it was an interesting revelation in the book that at least part of his interest in Chicago and working as a community organizer was with the thought in the back of his mind that this might be good, not in a using sense, but material for someone who had thoughts of writing novels.
I think that was a small part of it. I think he wanted to learn about life. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're stuck in college, and that's your experience of life, college and going to class and trying to get an A, you've got to be an idiot and to have learned nothing to think that somehow that's all that life has to offer. And I think there are a lot of people that come out of college and they want to take a bite out of life and see life and maybe some of its less happy scenes. And they do things like join the Peace Corps or Teach for America or volunteer or do any number of things that have a kind of idealistic thing attached to it. And yeah, I think he had thoughts about being a writer, but going to school, I knew dozens of kids who thought about being a writer and then of course never ended up being one. it's something you, it's like thinking about being a musician or an actor. It can be a little bit dreamy.
David Remnick is my guest. He's editor of The New Yorker magazine and author of The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. We would love to hear from you in this conversation. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Just a reminder again today, Jeff Whittington, wearing three hats, is also the one answering your phone. So if you call and you're waiting, just wait. We'll pick it up eventually.
Let her ring.
Let her ring, exactly. Please. Don't give up, or else, just do that, pick up the phone at 20 after, and then we'll be able to answer you.
Absolutely.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. We want you to call now to become a member of the station. You can also go online to kera.org. I'm having a great time with this conversation. David Remnick's book is hugely influential. It's been updated, and there's a new epilogue. We have it available as a thank you gift this afternoon, by the way, when you make a contribution at or above the $120 level. We really, so if you're interested in picking up a copy and supporting KERA, you can do it all at one time.
1-888-694-6931. Online at kera.org. Yeah, we're thrilled to be able to offer you a copy. Of course, the book's out in trade paperback. You can get your own copy and support the station however you want to, but we hope that you will do your part for the station today, because it's absolutely crucial that we hear from as many of you as possible. We've raised, thanks to many of you, $376,000, but our goal is $700,000, and we're only going to get there one call, one online contribution at a time, and we're hoping that you'll be the next one.
It's easy to make your contribution. It only takes a couple of minutes at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. It's really fun to be able to do this show for you, because you come to it, and we know, with a spirit of open-mindedness and curiosity, and you come with us to talk about everything from arts to politics to history to science to ethics to just everything. We have filmmakers coming on later this week. It's really a wonderful space to be able to interact with one another in North Texas and around the world, for those of you who listen via podcast and online. It's a great thing. It's kind of a luxury for a local station to have a show like this, because it costs money to produce it. Frankly, it's probably more expensive to produce this show locally than to take a couple of hours from somewhere else. But we feel like it's important to have something based in North Texas that reflects not specifically North Texas issues all the time, but reflects the spirit of this community and the things that we want to know about. Gives you a better chance to interact with our guests as well.
Well, the truth is, Chris, is that international and national issues of importance are North Texas issues, because we live in a world-class city.
It's a term from last hour if you weren't tuned in.
We live in, all of us, you and I, Chris, and everyone who's listening, you live in a very cosmopolitan community here in North Texas. And we respect that and we know that. And that's why intelligent, smart radio is important. That's why you listen. That's why you're listening right now, because you get something from KERA that you don't find anywhere else. And all we're asking you to do is your fair share. And your fair share can be a $35 annual contribution. Your fair share could be a $50 contribution every time we do a membership campaign, and that would be $150 a year. If that's right for you, then that's great. We would love to have your support right now. Maybe your fair share is a $1,500 Friends contribution. You get to decide, but please do make the decision to support the station today, because if we get your contribution today, then we can move on to other folks and get their contributions, and it'll snowball, no pun intended, and we'll get the drive over with.
We know you love public radio because you could be spending today curled up on the couch watching Lifetime movies and eating Haagen-Dazs from the tub, but instead you are listening to this station during the membership campaign. That means you're hooked. And so we would appreciate a contribution of financial support so that we can continue to keep public radio strong in this community across North Texas, on the web. Your contribution makes it possible. Please get in touch with us now at kera.org or on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with David Remnick, author of The Bridge.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Remnick. He is editor of The New Yorker and author of The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, David, Obama finally went to Harvard for law school, where he was chosen president as of the Harvard Law Review. At the time, it was a really fractured political environment, but he was known even then as a consensus builder. Can you talk
at
a little bit about
at Harvard?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, look, most of the kids at Harvard and most of the kids that were involved with the Law Review were in some way left of center, but there were conservatives. In fact, it was the Reagan era, and there was an increasing number of post Reagan era, but an increasing number of conservatives who liked judges like that. I mean, you now see like Scalia or Thomas and so on. And Obama was able to talk with those conservatives. He was able to, without hiding his own politics, which were liberal, have a dialogue with them. Not all the kids on the left were able to do that. And as a result, he won that position. And by winning that position, by becoming the first African American president of the Harvard Law Review, it was national news. It was on the wires. It was in the New York Times. It was everywhere. And as a result of that, he had a sense that, well, I could go places, not because of race, but because of my capacity to compete at the level of Harvard Law School. And he got all kinds of offers, Supreme Court clerkships, all the usual things. And what does he do instead? He returns to Chicago and begins his life in a much more modest way. Grassroots politics, a small civil rights law firm, that kind of thing. So it's interesting.
What kinds of mentors did he seek out for himself?
Well, he's very good at that. I've always found that people who are really successful are very successful at acquiring and learning from mentors along the way. Maybe a word to the wise for younger listeners. But certainly when he was at when he landed on the south side of Chicago, he had very important mentors who were community organizers. He learned from watching from afar Harold Washington as the first black mayor of Chicago. At Harvard Law School, he learned a lot from a number of law professors that took him in as a researcher and as a favorite student. He was like this all the way along. He did this when he got to the state Senate in Illinois, a pretty lowly position. A little exercise for everybody out there. Name your state senator. Most people can't do it. I'm not sure I could. And he kind of ingratiated himself with Emil Jones, who was the head of the Democratic Party in the state Senate. And when it came time to decide to run for U.S. Senate, Emil Jones got behind him, even though Emil Jones was a real, truly different and much more traditional African-American politician of the old school. So Obama had this skill all along. Even in the U.S. Senate, he acquired mentors, whether it was Richard Lugar or several others.
When he ran for U.S. Congress, he was defeated. Was that
in 2000?
Yeah, it's amazing to think how recent that was.
Well, yeah, I mean, and he didn't just get defeated; he got butchered. He made a really dumb decision, and his wife never hesitated to tell him how foolish it was to run for Congress in her old neighborhood on the South Side, where they now lived. And he ran against Bobby Rush, former Black Panther, who obviously, you know, cleaned himself up and became a much more mainstream but still left-leaning congressman on the South Side of Chicago. And Obama thought he could beat him. And, you know, in American politics, people in the House of Representatives tend to win election pretty automatically unless there's a reason to fire that person, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, some
corruption
scandal.
Charge,
yeah.
Right, or a scandal, or they've made a vote that was incredibly out of touch with the electorate, or they get very old. Some real mitigating reason against them continuing on. Bobby Rush hadn't done that. In fact, Bobby Rush's son, tragically, had been killed in a crime, so people felt terrible for him. Bobby Rush was adored by the people who tended to vote, which were middle-aged and older African-American women, They liked him. So just because Obama was kind of young and he went to Harvard, he wasn't running for the Chicago Law Review. He was running for the House of Representatives. And there was a real whispering campaign on the street, thanks to Bobby Rush's people, that Obama was the product of white money, Jewish money, that he was an outsider, that he wasn't authentically black, all this kind of ugly stuff. And he took it very hard. He lost almost 3-1.
We should also point out that this is a time in Obama's career where he was a not at all inspiring public speaker.
Well, he certainly was not the speaker that we came to know during the 2008 election or even the 2004 U.S. Senate campaign. Look, I know it seems odd to say, but piano players, athletes, writers, radio commentators, they get better with experience if they're paying attention. They learn things. And politicians learn how to be themselves, only more so. They learn the skills of fundraising. They learn the skills of public speaking. They learn the skills of policy. I mean, not enough of them. I mean, most of the ones that we confront on TV or radio or community life are mediocre or worse. But Obama was a real student.
How deliberate was his exploration of that sort of oratorical style that comes down through the black church?
Really deliberate. I don't mean cynical.
Yeah.
I don't mean inauthentic.
Well, for one thing, it works.
But, you know, somebody, this is a guy who did not grow up with Martin Luther King, who's probably the greatest orator in the history of the United States, but was extremely interested in the civil rights movement. And gave himself an education in the civil rights movement and listened to the speeches of King and learned the cadences of the church, not only from listening to King, but from his own experiences in church, and including Jeremiah Wright. That's not to say that he speaks like Jeremiah Wright, but you learn a thing or two about oratory by listening to these great preachers, the way they put together a speech, the way a political speech can resemble a sermon. After all, sermons are one of the great literary contributions to the oral tradition in American life. And he paid attention to those things. He's smart. This is the thing about Obama. What your listeners think about him politically is one matter, but he's extremely intelligent and not shy about thinking so.
You write that when he got to the Senate, which would seem, you know, for many people, this is a lifelong career goal and it's where they stay. He was very quickly bored.
Bored immediately. I mean, you know, he immediately realized that even though everybody was talking to him about running for president because of, well, first of all, he was the only African-American in the Senate. Second of all, he had made that big speech in Boston at the convention. Which excited everybody. But with the actual day-to-day work of sitting in committees and being in the minority, which the Democrats were at the time, and being very, very junior, so you're not given the most exciting tasks in the world. I mean, one source told me that the only thing that really made him come alive was when he went home at night and he started writing a second book. Hmm. Now, I think there's an element both of that's just interesting, and it's also one could even find that a little bit not without arrogance.
Yeah, it's almost as if he had become accustomed to sort of being the star, being the exceptional one in the bodies
well,
that he'd worked in.
You know, he was coming from the state senate where he wasn't exceptional anything. He was nobody. He was a state senator in Springfield, Illinois. Nobody knew who he was. And he had lost for Congress, but he had suddenly become this kind of political celebrity, not because of any great accomplishment on a national level, in fact, zero accomplishment on the national level, but because of a performance in Boston that had thrilled a lot of people who were watching him on television or in the hall.
What can you tell us about...
I'd say this. I'm somebody who voted for him. My magazine endorsed him for the presidency when it came time. But I'd be a fool to look away from the good fortune that has also followed Obama as a politician. Remember, when he ran for Senate in 2004 in Illinois, He was not favored to win on the Democratic side, and his main competitor, who was extremely rich and willing to spend lots and lots of money, Blair Hull, had to drop out of the race when his divorce records were revealed that he did all kinds of abusive things to his wife. That killed him. Obama became a Democratic nominee. Then he was running against an extremely attractive Republican who not only had made a fortune, but had also shown himself to be really charitable and a good guy. But when his divorce records came open, it featured, you know, adorable things like forcing his wife to go to a French sex club. That was the end of him. And Obama waltzed in. So, you know, again, half of life is showing up, and he did show up for the race, and he did run hard, but he also got a lot of breaks. And the minute he was elected senator, having accomplished absolutely nothing, the first press conference was all about, when are you going to run for president?
Hmm. How hard was it to convince Michelle Obama that running for president was a good idea?
I think it was much harder to convince Michelle Obama that a life in politics was a good idea. She really hated it mm-hmm. when he was living part-time or a lot of the time in Springfield during a given week and a given month. She was apart from him. She's raising young kids. They weren't making that much money. And here they were. They had both had gone to Harvard Law School and had every reason to believe that they would be, you know, among this generation of new urban professionals, black urban professionals, and wasn't doing that. He was, in her mind, idiotically spending all his time as a state senator. I think it's not really until he won for the Senate or ran for the Senate that she was fully on board. She was very irritated by the political life. Running for president was a matter of, is this the right time and will the security be there? Once she was convinced on both of those scores, she was fully in.
David Remnick is my guest. He's editor of The New Yorker and author of the newly updated book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. We'll resume our conversation with David in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We do have copies this afternoon of The Bridge, the newly updated version of this. They're available as a thank you gift if you want to join the station at the $120 level or above. As you can imagine, most of that money goes to KERA. A little bit of it goes for us to buy a copy of the book and send it to you. But if it's a good incentive for you to actually do this now, to get a chance to read the book and to support KERA at the same time, we would invite you right now to call 1-888-694-6931 or to go online to kera.org. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd, and hello to you. It's your radio station. It's up to you to do your part. I've been here this since about 6 o'clock this morning, and you know what? Many of you have responded, and I really appreciate the fact that many of you have taken the extra time today. We actually were Justin Martin and I were in the control room looking at the Twitterverse in there, and someone made a contribution and said, "Used my extra time home from work today to make my contribution to KERA."
Excellent, thank
so,
you.
Thanks so much to you, and you know what? If and I'm sorry I don't remember your name right now, but I'll look in a second. If you make a contribution to KERA today, why not get on your social network of choice and let everyone know that you've done your part? Because if we could just get everyone who believes the importance of this smart, intelligent radio, this kind of quality conversation, to do their part, the drive would end just like that, and we'd be able to get back to the regular schedule. And what better day than today, kind of an out-of-the-ordinary day, and as Ann Bothwell, my colleague this morning, was saying, make it an extraordinary day.
Assuming that you and everybody you care about is home, safe and cozy and warm, a day like this is a gift. You know, a snow day is you know, it's one of those wonderful things that happens every once in a while, every once in a blue moon here in this part of the country. You know, it's great. You've got that extra time. So now, although it only takes like 2 or 3 minutes to join the station, but regardless, there's nothing pressing right now besides this. And it's pressing because we would love to finish our fundraising and end this campaign as soon as possible. It's only possible if everyone who's going to make a contribution during this campaign does so. Now, for reasons that we'll never understand, a lot of you like to wait weeks and weeks, and then there's a good number of you that like to do it along the way. And we would encourage you to be in the group that acts earlier. You can do this by going online to kera.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931. The important thing is your participation. Whatever the amount might be is your choice.
Yeah, and Chris is absolutely right. It only takes a couple of minutes to do your part, and it's as affordable as you want it to be. It's the psychological distance that's tough to traverse, because in society today, we resist. We resist everything.
Because you're trying to resist the sales pitch.
That's right.
We're not selling you something you don't want. You want it.
We're not locking you in a room. You're waiting to enjoy your vacation so we can do a timeshare pitch. And there's nothing wrong with timeshares, you know, if that's your thing. But, you know, we're not asking you to consider something that you're not interested in. You're already interested in the station and the content. You use it. You listen. You participate. And you know, it's a part of your life. But it does take some time for you to agree and to decide in your internal dialogue, yes, I should, you know, I do listen to the station. I do get something. I have actually enjoyed this conversation with David Remnick about Barack Obama, and I really should do, yes, okay, I'm getting the phone. What's that number again? 888-694-6931. What's the website?
Google it.
It's kera.org. Okay. Where's my credit card? I mean, it takes some time, and we understand that, and that's why, you know, honestly, that's why these drives go on as long as they do, because once everyone who's going to contributes, the drive is over because we go till we reach the goal and the drive ends. And they always do end at some point. Someone does make that last contribution. So it just takes time. And we understand that. But we're here and our job is to remind you that it is really easy and you can do your part.
You might be listening because you know that nowhere else on the broadcast spectrum in North Texas could you hear a full one-hour interview with David Remnick about his book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. You might have heard it elsewhere, perhaps, you know, the hardcover version of the book, I think, came out last year. But that, you might have heard it in a little two-minute segment, or you might have heard a bunch of sound bites. There's nothing wrong with that, but we think there's great value to sitting down and having a more substantive discussion, to giving you the chance to interact with our guest, to speaking respectfully to everyone who comes on the show, no matter what viewpoints they have, as long as they are intelligent and well-reasoned and have the credentials, we welcome them. And we know that this is unusual. You know that this is unusual. Your support makes it possible when you go online to kera.org.
Go online to kera.org and make your contribution, or call 888-694-6931. It is unusual, but it is intelligent, and it is necessary that we hear from you. That you support this public radio station that you already listen to, that you use, and that you appreciate and love. So please don't wait any longer. KERA.org or 888-694-6931. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is The New Yorker editor David Remnick. His book is called The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. If you want to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. David, this is often not the case with books of this kind, but you, in fact, interviewed your subject pretty extensively. Is that right?
I did.
We hear him in public communications and in speeches being so very careful, it sounds, with every word. Is he more relaxed, more candid behind closed doors?
Not as president. Mm-hmm. I think as president, there is no such thing as behind closed doors unless you are a trusted aide, and journalists don't fall into that category. And Obama, unlike somebody like Bill Clinton, who can be, even in office, a kind of torrent of words, Obama is careful. I have to tell you, when I was in the Oval Office interviewing him, and you're never alone with him in this interview. There was David Axelrod and somebody else, you know, operating backup tape recorders. I just wonder how alone he ever is.
Mm-hmm.
He's so deliberate in his speech that you could hear the tick-tock of the grandfather clock that's in the Oval Office. It's a slightly Edgar Allan Poe-like atmosphere. You know, he's friendly. He's correct. All the words come out in perfectly formed paragraphs. But you can see that if you can watch somebody actually think, you know that he is thinking with great deliberation about how to put together these sentences and paragraphs, and to be, on the one hand, open just enough, but to be careful as well. Remember, being a president of the United States, if you misspeak in any way, or if you're careless, whole markets can plunge and troops can go off to war. So he's very, very careful.
Well, obviously you understand the reasons why he has to be that way. But
yeah, I'm not sure it's the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. Is it frustrating to you, though, as a journalist?
Well, to some degree, yeah, because when you're a journalist, you want, what's your goal? Your goal is the utterly candid, and that's not what you're getting in a president with any sense of self-discipline.
It sounds so different from the picture of himself that he gave us when he wrote Dreams from My Father. And first of all, was that...
Well, the context is different. You know, you're just in a different circumstance when you're a 23-year-old community organizer than when you're a 49-year-old president of the United States. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I will say that even as a 23-year-old community organizer, he was known by the church ladies and ministers and friends that I talked with, you know, as somebody who was already quite a disciplined character. The personality, I say this about Obama, I think he hides in plain sight. I think ideologically he is somebody of the center left and therefore ends up disappointing people farther to the left. He is who he has always said he is. When he gave a speech that was ostensibly and truly an anti-Iraq war speech in Chicago, a very important speech in his career, he spent most of the speech talking about when it is proper to go to war. He's not a pacifist. He is a liberal. And I think that goes with his personality as well. I don't think this is somebody who conceals, unlike some other personalities we could think of, a kind of roiling, novelistic, almost Dostoevskian, dark inner life. I just don't.
Why do you think, as you mentioned, there are people on the far left who've been very disappointed, and there are people on the far right, certainly, who just can't stand a word that comes out of his mouth. Why, though, has the Obama is a socialist, is a far leftist?
I wouldn't equate them, though. I, by the way, just to leap to the defense of the people that you're describing as the far left, and I would just say the left, I think the people on the far right, their means of attack very often are quite deceitful and filled with myths and disinformation. I think people on the left are disappointed for, by their lights, totally legitimate reasons, and they are just want him to be something that he isn't and is not going to be. Sorry.
I think it's
an important point.
I was gonna ask, though, why the rights charges against him have seemed to stick with people in the population, you know, that great sea of undecided voters, people who are not necessarily partisan, but these days in this country end up deciding almost every election.
Well, I think that the crazy charges that are leveled against him are really, for the most part, matters for the what is politely called the base, but less politely called the outer limits. I think that this business about his religion, his birthplace, is stuff that is ginned up by the political opposition, goes through the megaphone of Fox News and certain precincts of the internet, and does a lot of damage, but I don't think it is going to do decisive damage in the next election.
We saw his approval ratings rise after the Arizona shooting speech to a level higher than they had been since early in his presidency. How would you compare the effectiveness of that speech with the State of the Union that came days later?
Well, the contexts are radically different.
Yeah.
You're doing a different thing. You're performing in Tucson a very important emotional function as the consoler-in-chief, as well as saying some very, I think, stark and true things about the nature of our political dialogue. In the State of the Union address, the task was very different, in a sense more prosaic and less poetic and certainly not quasi-religious. It's there as you're setting out a legislative agenda, which is jobs, jobs, jobs. I'll reveal my own politics, but you know, there were a lot of things that went unsaid in the State of the Union address because they were too politically controversial. guns is one thing. The environment is another. But I think, you know, a State of the Union address at this point is the, in some ways, the starting pistol for the re-election campaign. And Obama knows very well that his biggest liability is 9.5% unemployment and all the things that come with it. Unemployment.
Sorry. Right. 9.5% unemployment, we'd kick out anybody.
Yeah. Rightfully so.
During the campaign, and I can't remember exactly where he said it, perhaps he said it multiple times, Obama indicated that he would rather be a one-term president who did the things he cared about than a two-term president who had to sort of
Well, they kind of all say that,
yeah.
Don't they?
Yeah. I'm wondering if you think
I mean, it's very noble to say, but I think they all want to be two-term presidents.
Do you think there's anything he's holding back on?
Pardon me?
Do you think there's anything he's holding back on at this point with an eye toward the 2012 election?
Well, I think there are certain issues that he does not speak the full extent of his opinion. I'll put it that way. Do I believe in my heart of hearts that Barack Obama gives a damn if two men or two women get married? I think in his heart of hearts, he wishes he could come forward and lead the charge on something like gay marriage, but he knows the political cost of that in this moment is risky, and he is often risk averse. You cannot take all the risks all at once. I happen to think we're going to look back at this era, and opposition to gay marriage is going to be looked upon with shame, real shame, in the way that we would look back on the 50s and think about opposition to integration, racial integration. I think you know, call me in 15 years and see if I'm right. I think I am, and I think Barack Obama agrees with me. But I think he is unwilling, for whatever political reasons, to take all the risks all at once, and presidents can't. Sometimes they feel that political circumstances and popular opinion has to lead them rather than him lead it.
The last thing
whether you like it or not.
Yeah, the last thing I want to ask you about briefly is, and I understand that this was written at a particular moment in his life, but is there anything, now that you have done independent research, when you look back at his, particularly the Dreams from My Father memoir, is there anything that you think that is notable that he left out or embellished in that struck you as different from reality?
Well, yes, but I don't think he makes any bones about it. I don't think if you look at the preface to the book, Obama tells you that he is taking certain liberties in the way that memoir writers do all the time. Mm-hmm. But the liberties are not like, you know, what's the writer's name, Fry, or it's nothing like that. It's occasionally taking two community organizers and forging them into one or changing names. But he tells you when he's doing it. To me, the rule is the reader needs to not be deceived.
Right.
The reader needs to know what the rules of the game are. And I think on those terms that he played by his own set of rules, and he told the reader as much.
David Remnick is editor of The New Yorker magazine and author of The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. It has been updated with a new epilogue and re-released in trade paperback. David, it's been such an interesting hour. I really appreciate you making the time to talk to us.
It was great fun to talk to you.
We appreciate all of you who have been listening this hour. If you would like to receive a copy of the updated version of David Remnick's book, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, we do have copies available as thank you gifts at or above the $120 contribution level. You can find out how to get yours by going online to kera.org or calling 1-888-694-6931. By the way, this would be a perfect amount if you are interested in setting up a sustaining membership, that, you know, monthly draw from your checking account. You can certainly set up a $120 or a $240 sustaining membership and choose this as your thank you gift. Whatever level you want to make a contribution at, we really appreciate your participation. Thanks.
Hey, Chris Boyd.
Hey, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Ann, Carol, and Alan. And hey, Alexandra, it's either Cheka or Chelka in Fort Worth. And hello, Barbara Brown in Denton and Ann W. Chapman in Dallas. Thanks so much for your contributions at 888-694-6931 or via the web, kera.org. Also want to thank Scott Coleman in Dallas. Want to thank Vanita Salvi in Dallas, who made a contribution in honor of her daughter Divya's birthday. Thank you very much, Vanita. And Doris Erickson in Keller, thank you very much for your contribution. We really appreciate the fact that on this extraordinary day with the weather outside and You're not letting Icepocalypse slow you down in your support of your public radio station. And, you know, I'm going to goof a little bit about it because, frankly, I've been on the air since 6 o'clock this morning. But it's been really invigorating and exciting to hear the response because many of you have stayed home today, thank goodness, and I'm really glad you're warm and safe. But you've taken the time to bridge that psychological gap and decide, you know what, I should support the station because I do listen to the station and I do get something out of it that I don't find anywhere else. An hour-long conversation with the editor of The New Yorker, author of The Bridge, very big deal. We're huge fans of his work, but more importantly, you got to hear him speak directly to you right here in Dallas.
You know, we say this all the time, and it remains true today. We don't bring every guest on expecting you to agree with them, to think everything they have to say is valid or gels with what you believe. We bring people on, and we ask them to explain how they have arrived at their conclusions. And one thing that I thought was interesting about David Remnick that some of our other guests in the past have done is he's very candid about his political views. And then he also sort of explains how he's arrived at them. We don't expect you to suddenly say, David Remnick is right about every single observation, but we expect him to be able to explain to you what he has learned and how he went about it. And I think from that perspective, it was a really interesting conversation. The great thing about public radio, about you as an audience, is that you don't come to us wanting to be fed things that automatically and without exception agree with your worldview. We think that's wonderful. You know, we'd like to take things, you know, we've had people on that had very critical ideas about the president and his performance. We don't necessarily want you to agree with them. We're just here to understand. And that's a beautiful thing and far too rare, I think, in mass media today. Your support of KERA makes this little oasis where we can talk about things respectfully from a variety of perspectives.
Yeah, what you believe is your business. And that's the ultimate foundation, I believe, of democracy. And that's why I am really proud to be able to be on the air and ask you to support a media institution that goes all the way to make sure that what you believe is your business and gives you as much information from as many different sides of an issue so that you can decide what you believe. And that's what we do here. That's what we do here. That's what NPR does in Washington. That's what it's all about. It's about giving you the tools that that you want, desire, need, and that you use every single day to decide what kind of citizen you are in this world. And you know, we're just asking you to support the service that does that for you. Whether it's Chris or whether I'm asking you to do it, if it would be someone else if it wasn't us.
And don't do it on our behalf. Do it on your behalf.
Absolutely. And you can do it by calling
1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and online at kera.org, where it just so happens you can easily make a contribution.
You can indeed. If you listen to this show on the podcast, we have found out that in December, about 82,000 podcast downloads. So there's no way that that's all Chris's father.
No, he's only got the one computer, and sometimes it's on the blink.
there's no way that he...
Sometimes my mom's doing QVC shopping.
He's responsible for all that. You know, many of you listen to the podcast, and we really appreciate that you download the podcast. But, you know, we as soon as we get off the air here, I'm going to go and get the podcast ready. And typically, we have staff members, our associate producer, Betsy Lewis, who diligently takes care of editing and producing and posting that podcast every day. You know, that's something that has a cost for the station. So if you get something out of that, then why not give something a little something back? If everyone who listened to the podcast gave $10 or $20 to the station, wow, we would really go far.
And in fact, last year there were 750,000 podcast downloads. If everyone who listened to each of those podcasts were to give a dollar, we would be done already with this membership campaign, which would be great. However, we would just ask that you can think about all those other people and you have no control over them, but you do have control over what you do. You can make a contribution right now in any amount at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Maybe you want a copy of The Bridge by David Remnick.
Yeah, it's available when you join the station at the $120 membership level. You can see that online at kera.org or if you call 888-694-6931 and say, I want to contribute $120. And you know what? $120, that's the price we put on the books, you know, typically, for because we do have some handling costs and getting acquiring the book and everything. But that's also about the average gift that a listener to KERA makes. So just decide. It's up to you. You can go online and do it, kera.org, or you can call.
Your contribution always matters, no matter what the amount. It could be $10,000. It could be $10. We really appreciate it. We'd love to hear from you now at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Thanks, and stay warm.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.